It's simple. It's dumb. It's the podcast. Welcome to the second episode of It's Simple, It's Dumb, It's the Podcast. As mentioned last episode, this project began as a Twitter project dedicated to ranking Jason Lytle's songs, and it has now transformed into a podcast solely focused on discussing Jason's music with friends and fans of Jason's. This episode's guest is Stevie Scullion, better known as Melodian, an immensely talented singer-songwriter from Northern Ireland. I don't believe you. Being a fan of Granddaddy for close to 20 years, Melodian was able to convince Jason to help produce his fifth studio LP, Hum, one of the best albums released in 2020. In this episode, Melodian will share how he first heard Granddaddy, and he'll reveal a few stories about Jason that took place while working on Hum and being on tour. And, as is the case in every episode, we will ask him to reveal his favorite song of Jason's. Here's my conversation with Melodian. Hey, Stevie, do you recall the first time that you heard Granddaddy's music?
I can remember the exact moment. It was a really big moment for me. There used to be a show on Irish TV called No Disco. It was a really class show. So I think it was Thursday nights it used to be on. And I used to watch it, and I'd have it muted if I didn't like the song, and then every time a new song come on, I would unmute it. So I'd be playing the guitar and trying to make up stuff, you know, as like dreaming of being a songwriter or whatever. And one of the times I unmuted it was Jason, do you know when he has the two guitars sellotaped together in Summer Here Kids? So that was my first introduction to Jason's just everything. And it was like his voice and everything, the way that he didn't sound like really polished, like, do you know what I mean? It wasn't Top of the Pops, it just sounded real. I don't know. I think the thing, like the big secret with Jason, is that it's so lo-fi, but it's also so hi-fi or something. It's so cool, but it just gets you. You know what I mean? His production's insane, and it's so clever because he's making you think the opposite. He's making you think that it's this real lo-fi thing, but it's not. It's mad. He tricks you into it, and he just totally sucked me in. Even the fact that he had the two guitars sellotaped together with duct tape or something, I was like, what the hell is this? So I really loved him from there and anything I heard from then, but I didn't really go out and investigate enough until a friend gave me a CD, and he was working with a guy who's like, he's one of the main music writers here now. And he had just been to see Granddaddy in Belfast, and I think there were like about 20 people there or something. So it's become this legendary thing. And he gave my friend the CD after it. And he's like, saw this amazing band. He called the guy Dave Roy, and he's like always on the pulse, you know what I mean? He's always up the front of the gigs and all. A really cool guy. And about 2 weeks later, my friend gave me the Software Slump. And I was raging as soon as I heard it. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe they played in this real small place in Belfast called The Front Page. And we had missed it by 2 weeks. I saw them in Edinburgh on the Someday tour.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, like, we were on a balcony sort of overlooking the stage. And the sound was so good, boy. They were so, so tight.
So you've obviously been a fan for a really long time. How does one transition from being a fan to the point where you're reaching out to see if there's any interest in working on an album together?
It was really weird, man. I've always had Jason in mind for like producing something. It's weird because now that it's happened and you're thinking back, it all becomes this weird thing, like by some sort of stalker or something. But do you see the guy I was talking about, Neil? I remember doing a thing with him like around Software Slump, just after Software Slump, and it was like we were in our first band together and all this, so like he's sort of always kept me right with music, so we were having a music thing about if you could have any band, what would it be? So I picked the Beatles, and he made me pick a band that was alive. Like the whole band had to be alive. So the band I picked was Jerry Love from Teenage Fan Club, Joey Warrenker on drums. So I knew his stuff from Bacchanal. And then Jason. And it's mental, man. So it's turned out that's some of the lineup on Hum. So, like, ever since I heard the Software Slump, if I was in a studio and we were talking about a certain song and there was a sound, sometimes I'd be saying, it's like the Beatles on a certain album, you know, like a certain period of the Beatles or something, or it's like a wee bit like the band or something. You know, if you're like sort of trying to explain an arrangement. But all the time, it would be Granddaddy. So the sound in my head, the closest sound in my head all the time was Granddaddy. It's weird the way it happened. I didn't really think I was ever close to the stage of asking him. But I don't know, I took a notion. Same as with Joey, I just took a notion and contacted him. And then I met Jerry through another friend. I ended up supporting Teenage Fan Club one time. But it's really weird. I think I freaked them all out. I told them about it and freaked them all out.
So what was your reaction to finding out that he agreed to produce it?
It was mad, but he responded really quick. And like, he seemed really, really nice and really positive and all. And he said he was definitely up for something and sent him over some songs. And then he came back and it was mentally, he was just like super positive all the time. You would send him something or he would send me something. And he just seemed pure cool from the start. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So had you ever had any similar experience of working remotely from somebody when you're collaborating with them like this?
I had, because the album previous to this was something similar, and that was with Joey. So, Let Your Weirdness Carry You Home, you call that one. I made that with Joey Warrenker on drums. He plays on that whole album, and Jerry Love plays bass, a good bit of bass on it. So I'd met Jerry a few years before, and then we'd all ended up on that one. But so the sort of thing we were aiming for with Weirdness was that Joey would be finishing the mix and stuff like that. And then he ended up going on tour with Roger Waters. And in hindsight, he was saying he could mix it in his bedroom on his headphones and all. And I didn't really have enough experience at the time. I was thinking, surely you can't be doing that. You know, you need to be doing it in a studio with speakers and stuff like this here. But I'm sure he would have done it. I ended up mixing it. I tried to get loads of different people involved and I couldn't really find the right person. And I ended up doing it myself. And I probably should have just let Joey do it. He would have done a far better job than me. But that's why... With the next album, like I had a lot of stuff already sort of on the go. Those songs from Hum, mm-hmm. But I knew I needed someone else to help me mix it. You know, it's an art form. It's weird. That's what I mean about Jason being an artist. Like mixing and all is an art form too. You know, you have to learn so many different things, and it's like the technical side to mixing is so overwhelming and complicated that it's hard then to get into the artistry of it, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like whenever then boys used to mix on desk and all, and you see Albini mixing all, you know, they're sort of playing the desk because they have everything sorted. If you don't know what you're doing with some of the stuff, you can get bogged down a wee bit in that, and it's just not a, like someone like Jason just takes it to a whole new level, like.
You just brought up Steve Albini, who recorded your third LP, This Is Nowhere. What was different about your experience with Albini compared to your experience with Jason?
Albini's class and all, but he doesn't like to give too much into it, like and sway in certain ways. That scenario, though, was a wee bit hard on him because we were trying to make an album in 4 days. Including mixing it. And, you know, why should you put him on the spot and go, here, does this feel right? If he says no and it takes you half a day to figure that out, are you going to, you know, people turn around and go. So he was sort of saying, look, you're trying to make an album in 4 days here. I'm doing my job here recording it. You know, he had everything sitting lovely by you. So he's a genius, like, you know, but he's obsessed with things probably in a different way than Jason. Although Jason seems to be a bit obsessed with that world as well, you know what I mean? But Albini, I think, just loves, like, he knows his room inside out. He knows all his gear inside out. So he's like the master of that in there, you know what I mean? He knows exactly what the sound is in his head. Mm-hmm. So it must be mad for people, like, if you have that, you know, it must be intense.
I guess you made a good point, though. Trying to do a record in 4 days is probably pretty insane.
Yeah.
And you can't really expect the producer to be giving you a lot of constructive feedback on how to arrange songs differently or do things like that, because you're just going to run out of time.
And especially him, like, because, I mean, that's what he's known for, just being, like, he calls himself an engineer. He doesn't call himself a producer or anything. Mm. He doesn't charge producers rates or anything like that. That's what was so mental and so cool about him. Like, someone sent me a link one time to a film. It's on YouTube, I think. It's about the Magnolia Electric Company. Jason Molina, is that what you call him? It's about his band going, like, on this road trip. I think they do a bit of a tour. And they end up at Electrical Audio and they make this album with Albini. So I watched this documentary and it was class. And then I went, just out of curiosity, I went on to the studios. I just Googled the studio, you know, and went on to their website. Because in the documentary, Albini's like sort of geeking out about rooms and stuff. I used to study architecture, so I'd be interested in, like, he was talking about we were changing the volume of rooms by using grills around the side of it and all this kind of like. So on the website, I noticed there was a rates And I clicked in to see how much the studio was to hire. And it tells you Steve Albini's daily rate. And it was like, immediately it was affordable. Do you know, as soon as you seen it, it was like, I had a plan in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and for him to offer that to bands is so style. So, like, Joey says the first thing he did when I contacted him about working together, even onto YouTube or whatever, and he watched Colin's film, and he says he was instantly intrigued because of the Albini thing, and Jason said the same thing. So, like, Albini offering that to small independent artists is insane, because it starts to open doors for you.
So once Jason agreed to come aboard and work on the album, what was the arrangement? What did that look like?
The way it sort of started off, man, was like, I think I mentioned at the start, like, I needed someone to help me mix. I think maybe. I can't remember the exact details now, but it wasn't planned for it to be as involved for Jason as it got. I don't know why, like, he would have to talk to him, but I think he ended up playing on every song, if not, I think he did. He played on everything and sang all over the album, and like, that wasn't the intention at the start. I think it was like supposed to be a couple of songs or something. And then for him to come over, he came over here to Ireland to mix it and all, and we did the tour and all. I think he seemed just to be into stuff by him. We ended up doing a couple of co-writes and all, and maybe he just fancied it. A holiday, you know, he came over here, he had a class time here, he's up running up mountains all over the show.
What was it like working with Jason, given what many feel is his preference for songwriting and recording by himself?
Like, we had that week in the studio when we were here. When we were making it before he came to Ireland, there would be periods where he would just go off into the mountains or whatever and be really quiet, and then he'd come back and he'd send you a whole load of stuff that he'd done or whatever. So, like, the week in Ireland, we thought that was the album was finished before we even got into the studio in Ireland. And we had some ideas about doing maybe more tracks or just adding in, having a bit of crack, you know. So that week was really, really enjoyable. And Jason seemed to love it. Like, being in the studio with other people and being able to just jump from instrument to instrument and have fun while someone was engineering, he seemed to love that. And he's mental on the drum. Like, everything he picks up, he's class at playing. He's like a shredder and all. You only see him doing all Van Halen and stuff and all too. He's mental. He did the solo. There's a solo on
The Golden Age?
Yeah. He did that solo on his 50th birthday. So he says he got blocked. I think he was drinking tequila or something and gave himself a birthday present, Van Halen solo. This is real. Do you want to see him doing it? It's mental. Even on an acoustic. We were in Edinburgh and he'd got food poison and he's playing the acoustic, and next thing he's just shredding on the acoustic. Mental. At the end of that, the mixes weren't sitting right. There was a problem with the room, that the room had been changed around and had never been mixed from this position. We were doing it sort of for the comfort. And because we thought it was already more or less mixed anyway. But somehow all this sort of sub sound got into the mix. And the room was just absorbing it. So it was weird. Jason and this other guy, Ben McCauley, was helping us. They had sort of become used to the room throughout the week, and I was having that much good crack. I was just going in and out and making sandwiches and tea and all that there, and just more or less having the crack instead of sitting. Do you know, like, sometimes you're in the studio, you're just in the middle of the speakers all the time, it's intense or whatever. I was just having crack. So at the end of the week, they thought it was all sounding class, and I was like, boys, this reeks. It reeks. But it ended up Jason had, he was the one who got it over the line then. he seemed to love being in the studio with other people, but to actually get the finished result that he needed, he ended up having to be the one on his own, obsessing over it, you know, in his own time and space.
What can you tell us about your experience meeting Jason for the first time?
Yeah, it was weird, man. It was like, because we seemed to get on really well the whole way through making it and all, you know, and then I had all this mad shit going on at the time as well, so I didn't really have time to think about it until I had to go and pick him up in Dublin. And I remember just thinking, first of all, what if he thinks I'm a dick? And then thinking, what if he's a dick? I have to stay with this boy for the next fucking 7 weeks or something. What if he's a dick? And but he wasn't. And, you know, we seemed to get on good. It was brilliant crack.
During the tour, a mannequin named Tiffany joined you and Jason, creating some memorable moments that were shared through social media. Can you walk us through the backstory of Tiffany?
So whenever we were in the studio, every day, every couple of days, at lunchtime, we'd go in and stock up or whatever. And one of the days we were walking through this department store and there was a family of mannequins, like all set up. So next thing, Jason got in beside him and he was posing as if he was one of the family. So I took his photo and next thing, everywhere we went, he was jumping into windows and all and doing, pretending to be a mannequin. And we were putting them online. Do you know the guy, Hi Gelb? So Hi Gelb started doing the same thing and sending back to Jason. So that's laughing my head off. Like, both of them pretend to be mannequins and they're sending these things back. So after the tour started, we were doing a gig in Waterford in the south coast of Ireland. It was like a Saturday morning or something. We were walking back to the van to leave. And I was trying to remember where we were going. I think we might have been going to Galway, actually. We were going to Galway. It's a long drive too. So it was early in the morning and Saturday morning. And we're walking past this shop window and there was all these mannequins. So I was like, here, imagine if we got a mannequin and stuck it in the van. Your man, Harry Gale, would be freaking out. So Jason just walks on up the van and he says he didn't know what I'd done until I come out with it. But I was in the shop and these two young girls, like all Saturday morning, all hungover and all. And I says to them, here, do you have any spare mannequins? And one of them just sort of looks me up and down, totally disgusted. You know what I mean? I just walks off. That doesn't even say anything. Just walks off. And the other one gets all excited. And she's like, yes, there's loads. And then she brought down Tiffany. And she's like, she didn't even take any money for it or anything.
Oh, you didn't have to pay for her. Wow.
Yeah. So then next thing I goes out. And I'm walking up the street with Tiffany. And Jason just sees me coming, starts laughing his head off.
I love that story. It never gets old. After the album and the tour were completed, and the COVID-19 pandemic was kind of spreading around the world, you and Jason started to work remotely again on a song called The Singularity.
Bars go up and smile. Never need to leave your home. These days kids play on their own.
After its release, you created the Jason Lytle Challenge on social media, encouraging others to cover the song and share it online. Were you surprised by the response that this received?
I don't know. I thought there would be even more. Because I knew there would be so many people who are just into Jason's production, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, most people who are into indie music must be fans of Granddaddy, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, whatever the Irish indie sort of scene that I am aware of, like, I'm sure he's hugely influential. Like,
did Jason give you a heads up that Admiral Radley was going to cover the Singularity?
Yeah, he told me about that, but I can't remember what way it happened beforehand, but yeah, that was mental right enough.
Hold on, disease. For the Singularity.
When he sent me that on a Friday night, I think. It was a Friday or else a Saturday, because I remember I was sitting in the kitchen with Julianne, and yeah, I was mental. Hearing that was insane.
It was so different from the original song. I thought it was so cool. But yeah,
it was pure style. Like, and I love Admiral Radley as well. I used to play it. Do you know the song The Thread?
Yeah.
Okay. I used to play that on repeat all the time, man. It's such a beautiful song.
Do you have a favorite song of Jason's that you'd like to mention?
Everyone's going to hate me, but he's simple, he's dumb, he's the pilot.
Adrift again, 2,000 men. You lost your maps, you lost the plan.
I think it's just because, like, I don't know, I was going to say because The Software Slump's such a big album for me, you know, but it's probably that is a big part of that as well, you know what I mean? It's just, I don't know, it's magic. That's what I mean about the lo-fi, hi-fi thing, because that it starts so lo-fi and all, and then he's just suckered you in, and before you know it, it just all feels warm and fuzzy. Genius, like. Do you remember the? Do you ever see the film Trainspotting?
Oh, I love Trainspotting.
Well, do you know the bit where he sort of sinks into the floor?
Yes.
Well, whenever I was in university, whenever my friend gave me the Software Slump, I was living in a flat, and it was so cold in the flat that we had abandoned half of it, and there was mushrooms growing through the wall, and all this was grim. So, to save money, we were going into, it was like a two-bedroom flat, so we were using this other guy's room sort of as a living room as well. So we'd go in there all night and have the heater on. Fucking, he conned me. Have the heater on in his room, and then at the end of the night, I'd have to go into my room, which was like walking into an icebox. So before I get into bed, we used to do, you know, a big bong. So we'd do a bong, and then I'd go into this freezing room and like be laying in bed shivering. But I'd put like these big headphones on and put on the Software Slump. So I'd just be shivering for the whole start of the song. And as soon as it went hi-fi, it was as if I was sinking into the bed like Trainspotting. And it just all got warm. I was like, this is the best thing ever. I was torn between Summer Here Kids because, like, that's a real vivid memory for me. The first time I saw them, you know, and heard that sound, it was like, holy moly. So I was torn between them two, but, like, music that can make you warm when you're freezing. You can't argue that.
I heard all your controls were jammed. Well, it's just nice to have you back again. But I guess they still don't understand. And they can never understand.
Yeah, he's aiming like, I mean, Jeff Lynne's his big sort of sonic hero, or one of them anyway, isn't it? So, like, he has the sound in his head and, you know, he has the talent to do it. So it must just, I don't know, he wants to run up a mountain, but he also knows that he has to perfect this thing that he has in his head and he wants to get out. He seems to be a very, very disciplined person, like.
Yeah.
You know, and then, like anything, you know, he needs to blow off every now and again, but he's a cool guy, like.
Are you giving in 2,000 men?
That was mental, like a really emotional thing for loads of people in the audience. The first night of the tour, we played this church in Belfast. And like everybody was coming up after going, that was mental. And the whole way through that tour, it was grown men crying the whole way through the tour.
Was the first Granddaddy song that I'd ever heard. I remember I bought Software Slump, was in a record store, and I looked at the back of the album and there's this guy in all white wearing a cowboy hat holding a keyboard in like a desert. Yeah. And I'm like, what is this album? I gotta get this.
He's holding a synth.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just remember when I put it on, that was the song that first played and I was hooked.
Yeah, it's madly.
Given in 2,000 men. Are you given in 2,000 men? Don't give in. 2,000 men.
Well, that wraps up our episode this week. I hope you enjoyed it. Special thanks to Milojan for taking the time to speak with me. Join us in 2 weeks for our third episode, where we'll speak to another guest about their times working with Jason and their love of Jason's music. In the meantime, continue to share and subscribe, and feel free to reach out with feedback or suggestions for future guests. Stay safe, everybody.